So this is work by Dana Watnick. So Dana is the Director of Research Methods and Data Analysis in the Prevention Intervention Research Center for Child Health at Albert Einstein College of Medicine, where she researches adolescent risk behavior and HIV STIs and early pregnancy. She's also pursuing doctoral studies of public health at the Graduate Center for the City of New York. Her doctoral studies focus on young men and social determinants of pregnancy, as well as dual protective methods for HIV contraception. Dana actually could not be here with a last-minute emergency, so on her behalf, we have the second author, who is Dr. Rosie Chabra. So Rosie's going to do this for us, so thank you.
Hello, everyone. I'm a faculty member in the Department of Pediatrics at Albert Einstein College of Medicine, and I was engaged as an interviewer and also for data analysis for the study. I'm also the co-investigator for the study. So, but I do have my cheat sheet so from Dana's presentation, so I'm going to try and do justice to her work today. Let me tell you a little bit more. So, for people who kind of do this kind of work, they should be very familiar schema for the treatment cascade, showing the number and the proportion of the HIV-positive people who get tested, linked, engaged, and are eventually virally suppressed. Now, at this cascade model shows the number of New York City at the end of 2012, and 41% is significantly higher than the national number of HIV-positive people who are virally suppressed by about 15%, as was shown by one of the presenters, that nationally it's more about 25%. So we must be doing something right in New York, at least trying to. Okay, the study rationale, it's like I showed you that the last slide as a context, that was the whole cascade, because we were part of the ECHIP initiative in which the local departments of health partnered with the Center of AIDS Research in 9 of the 12 U.S. cities with the highest HIV prevalence. So we at the Einstein CIFAR in the Bronx partnered with the New York City Department of Health to research an issue of most concern to our city. And they wanted to better understand the barriers and facilitators of engagement and retention of care to 4 key subpopulations. And in this presentation, I'm going to talk about one of those subpopulations, the African immigrants. The other 3 populations that we focused on are transgender women, MSM, young MSM, and recently incarcerated. But for this presentation, it's just going to be about African immigrants. So how did we get them? This was a qualitative study. We began with stakeholder interviews and the key informants and also the care providers who were familiar with or served this population. So all of the city, we called up various places and we're able to interview quite a few stakeholders and providers to really actually come up with the themes and the questions that we wanted to ask this population. So those are followed by in-depth interviews with 20 African immigrants living with HIV. In the interest of time, we will just focus on the results of the interview with the people living with HIV. Now, the most participants were recruited through one community-based organization serving this population in New York City, which happens to be the only formal CBO in New York City serving this population called the African Services. And then those participants continue to snowball sample other participants, as, again, one of my presenters also talked about earlier. It's like you get one person and then they kind of refer other people into the study. So all were adults aged 18 and older. All were born in Africa. All had been diagnosed with HIV for at least 3 months. And because you're focusing on engagement, all had to have been linked to care at some point through this time, at least once. The study was ruled to be exempt according to our Einstein IRB. So there were 3 different highly trained interviewers. I'm a clinical psychologist by training. Dana was another one. And we also have another MPH level person who also did the interviews. We conducted 1-hour in-person interviews that were recorded and transcribed, and I have to tell you, some of these interviews with women did end up being like an hour, 45 minutes to 2 hours, because there was just so much that they wanted to share. Nobody had really actually taken the time to sit down and talk to them about what's going on in their life and why things were difficult and all. So as a clinical psychologist, I guess I related it at different levels. So some of my interviews went much, much longer than 1 hour. Following data collection, a team of four interdisciplinary analysts developed a code book over many, many, many hours. And all 20 interviews were then coded by two analysts. So there were 20 interviews per population. So 20 interviews for African immigrants, 20 for recently incarcerated, 20 for MSM, and 20 for transgender women. So 80 altogether. Again, the background, as you can see, the mean age was 45 years, 65% were women, and they were from 8 different African countries. Over 3/4 were engaged in care soon after a diagnosis. Once engaged, all of them stayed consistently engaged from the beginning. There was no break for those people. And that was kind of an interesting aspect that we found. So, as you can see this image captures a lot of what we heard about. Not so much about the simple fact of being a fish out of the water, but more so the hardship of being out of the water and being in between two different fish bowls. So one fish bowl being the tight-knit community of Africans in the U.S. who help each other to find jobs and housing and kind of just support. And they take care of each other's children, offering comfort and cultural connections to the homeland. And the other one being Africa, where most of the family and the sense of identity originates for all of our immigrants, where social status is important. And as an immigrant in America, for many of us, you carry a heavy burden of expectation of success and really doing something so that you can help others in your community. So these are our results. So one of the main things we heard from Africans One of the main things we heard from Africans telling their stories was how our initial assumptions were sort of off mark. It wasn't about engagement level where they were having difficulties. It was at the beginning, at the testing level, how to get them to go for testing. That was the main issue that came out. So remember this slide, like on the left from the beginning, that shows that the continuum of care for New York City population as a whole. Well, we had assumed that Africans fell off the continuum of care somewhere in between, following a linkage visit at a point of care to engagement. However, after hearing their stories, as I said earlier, about their diagnosis and treatment patterns, we found that they didn't follow this population level trajectory. Rather, their biggest hurdle was at the point of testing, which they only did if they were very sick, usually hospitalized or pregnant after they coming to U.S. So, and once they were tested, they almost always skipped over to the other component of care continuum until they're self-reported as having viral load suppression. So all of them stayed engaged once tested. And there were different issues that I'm going to tell you why and how. The exception to this was those who had housing issues that prevented them from keeping HIV medications in their personal belongings for the fear of HIV status disclosure. I actually had a young girl, like in her mid-20s, who had medication in her bag. And one of her roommates saw it, and within 1 week, everybody from that apartment had left the place, and she was all alone. So that's something that they had to deal with. So they did not want to keep medication at home, and they wanted to kind of keep it at work, but they couldn't keep it at work because people at work would find out. So there were all these issues that they were dealing with. Now, what were the barriers to testing and treatment for this population? So as we first established, the problem was not engagement in care. It was more about the barriers along the treatment cascade to testing and getting into the treatment. As with other immigrant populations, being an immigrant posed multiple barriers to treatment. Undocumented immigrants feared coming to obtain care because it would result in deportation. Immigrants had language barriers. Insurance was a very major concern. Second, the stigma of HIV in the country, in the African community, is very pervasive and oppressive. For anybody who's worked with that population would understand. An HIV diagnosis has significant life consequences. They depend on their local immigrant community for work, housing, support, and they're disclosing everything if their diagnosis is known to everybody else. So that's like a very, very big issue. From friends, family, the community, the ostracism from their friends and family and the community is their biggest fear because that's the only level of connection they have in this country. And they fear that they will die alone in a strange land. And many, many of our interviewers did did say that. Support and communal relationships are important. People would rather go without care than jeopardize these social connections, especially in their home community in Africa. So they would not even tell somebody else over there. Because if they shared something with a friend over here, the other community back home in Africa would find out as well. AIDS in Africa for many years has meant gruesome illnesses because of comorbidities and lack of treatment and often dying alone and outcast because of the severe stigma. The third major thing was African immigrants were not engaged in care, reported many life stresses that keep them from care, such as unstable housing, hunger, and rape, among many others. Now, facilitators to engagement. So what explains the high rate of engagement? How come, like, everybody who gets tested and is able to stay, like, over 75% are able to stay engaged in care? For most, it is the stark contrast of the lack of care in Africa and the high mortality there. The fact that in the U.S. they can get medical care and access to ARVs is a gift for which they are endlessly grateful, which everybody kind of mentioned again and again and again. And a lot of them ended up crying because saying that I'm so grateful that I have this care that I'm getting here now. The second reason for engagement is the provider. All participants, without mentioning any significant one, mentioned how important their providers was, showing that they really cared. Once they connected to the provider, they really stayed connected. And all the providers they seemed to have really seemed to care for the patients. They gave them their personal numbers. Most of them say that my provider treats me like a family member, really calls on me, and she's like my mother, she's like my sister. So it was just very, and she's like, he's my best friend who really calls me and says if I'm doing well or what do I need. So providers were like a very, very major deal. The third reason mentioned for engagement was being a parent. This was expressed more so by women than women, that they wanted to stay in care and be healthy for their children. In conclusion, living through the experience of HIV/AIDS in Africa haunts those who migrate to U.S., preventing them from even getting tested. So testing was the major biggest hurdle. However, getting sick or not being there for their families were overriding factors for accepting treatment. So that should be one of the things that we should be thinking about for future interventions with this population. So once they are diagnosed, they are motivated to get care for their HIV by staying healthy for themselves and their families. Families are a very big motivation here. Africans are truly grateful for the HIV care they receive, including the care by specialist providers that they care and trust. And community-level interventions are definitely needed to address HIV stigma and immigration concerns and issues arising from unstable housing. And to end this, Dana wanted me to give a special thanks to the HIV/AIDS section for their generosity and recognition of this work. Dana got an award for Best Abstract for this as a student. And also, we would like to thank our collaborators and the DCDC for funding this study for us. Thank
you. Any questions?
They were all diagnosed here in the U.S. One or two of them seemed to feel that they were not doing that well in Africa, but they never got tested. So they did not know this. They had doubts, but they never got tested. They only got tested here.
Did they want to be seen in Africa and they couldn't get in, or?
No, I think that was one of the things. They did not want to be seen in Africa either, because over there it sort of meant that if they tested positive, they would not really have access to any medication.
I see.
So in some ways, they probably did not even want to find out.
I see. Okay.
Not in my interviews, but I heard stories differently, that there was a woman who was in her late 60s whose husband died of HIV and she didn't want to get tested because she didn't want to find out until she got very sick, where she was actually talked by a counselor into getting tested. So.
Thank you very much. Oh, yes.
Thank you.
I think we found a similar rate here. African men are much, much harder to get in to go for testing, definitely. It's very true. You know, that's a question that we've been asking, and I would assume it would, because most of these people, when they tested, they had already advanced to AIDS. Some of them were HIV positive and symptomatic, so I would assume that, but there's not much data that can kind of really show, and this is one of the interventions that we've been thinking about on how to really increase testing in the community so that people can get caught very way before. I would agree with that. The people who were in our interview had been here for an average of about 5 to 6 years. There was like one person who was here like for the last 1 year, and their perception hadn't changed that much. In Africa, it was still considered like a death sentence. But over here, they felt like, oh my God, I'm healthy, and I can really do everything that I want to do, and I can still support my family. So they were very grateful for that. But I wouldn't know in general, because this was a very small group.
Thank you so much.